Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Thursday, November 23rd, 2023. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Lisa Horsch and Mark Morrison. And may we wish you a happy Thanksgiving. And here is Mark with our first front page story.
60 years after JFK's death, Kennedys choose other paths. This is out of New York. Patrick Kennedy, son of Senator Ted Kennedy and nephew of President John F. Kennedy, remembers being a young state legislator in Rhode Island some 30 years ago and hearing encouraging words from the opposition leader at the time. Quote, "I just want you to know that no matter what you do, nothing's going to take away from everyone's memory and appreciation of what your family has done for this country," Republican David Dumas told him. He meant that don't preoccupy yourself with worrying about whether you're a good representative of your family or not, Patrick Kinney, now a former congressman, said in a recent interview. Kennedy spoke shortly before the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, a seismic national event that predates most American lives but remains an inflection point in the country's history. As a wellspring of modern conspiracy theories, as a debate over what JFK might have achieved, as an emotional cornerstone of the Kennedy story. The anniversary arrives at an unusual moment for Kennedys. It's a moment when the family's mission to uphold a legacy of public service and high ideals competes for attention with the presidential candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., whose anti-vaccine advocacy and inflammatory comments about everything from the Holocaust to the pandemic have led to a rare public family breach. Tradition in public eye. The current prominence of Robert Kennedy Jr., what Patrick expects will be a footnote to a larger narrative, doesn't stand out merely because of what he says and how it departs from family history. It stands out because he is the rare Kennedy these days engaged in national electoral politics. During JFK's 1960s through 63 presidency, governing was decidedly a family affair. Robert Kennedy was Attorney General, and the president's closest advisor, brother-in-law Sergeant Shriver, was heading the newly formed Peace Corps. His brother-in-law, Stephen Smith, was White House Chief of Staff. Youngest brother, Ted Kennedy, was elected to John F. Kennedy's former Senate seat in Massachusetts. The death of President Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy's remembrance of his administration as a lost golden age Camelot intensified feelings about the family and longings for their presence. Ted Kennedy became a revered liberal voice and legislator, while Shriver was chosen as George McGovern's running mate in their unsuccessful 1972 presidential campaign. Patrick Kennedy was an 8-term congressman from Rhode Island. Joseph Kennedy II, Robert's son, served 6 terms as a congressman from Massachusetts, and Joseph's sibling, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, was a 2-term Maryland lieutenant governor. Arnold Schwarzenegger, married at the time to JFK's niece, Maria Shriver, was California's governor for 2 terms. But the Kennedys have mostly withdrawn from electoral politics in the 21st century. No Kennedy or Kennedy-in-law currently serves in Congress or as a governor. Caroline Kennedy, JFK's daughter and only surviving child, had been open in 2009 to replacing Hillary Clinton in the U.S. Senate after Clinton was appointed Secretary of State by President Barack Obama. She soon stepped back amid signs New York Governor David Paterson would not select her. He didn't. Patrick Kennedy, who left Congress in 2011 amid struggles with a substance abuse and bipolar disorder, agrees the current political atmosphere is far removed from the 1960s, when leaders such as JFK had a sense of common purpose, but he still believes public office is worth pursuing and notes that his wife, Amy, ran for Congress in 2020 unsuccessfully. Quote, when we got out there and campaigned, it was very inspiring, Patrick Kennedy said. There were tons of people in the grassroots who were so inspiring to see how they were so passionate about changing the world. Administration remembered in spirit. The Kennedy administration now lives on more in spirit than in firsthand memory. One of the last prominent White House aides, speechwriter Richard Goodwin, died in 2018. The last of President Kennedy's surviving siblings, former U.S. Ambassador to Ireland, Gene Smith, died in 2020. Robert F. Kennedy's widow, Ethel, is in her 90s and rarely comments publicly. Starting in 1968, after the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Ted Kennedy was the family's standard bearer and chosen orator. But no one has succeeded him since his death in 2009. The death of Caroline's brother, John F. Kennedy Jr., in a 1999 plane crash, ended the life of his generation's most prominent family member, the one most discussed as a possible presidential candidate. Caroline Kennedy has maintained a low profile as ambassador to Japan during the Obama administration and ambassador to Australia in the Biden administration. That's an awesome responsibility and a huge yoke around your neck to try to have to carry that, Patrick Kennedy says of his father's stature. And Dad really did it. He really kept it together, but it was an incredible personal toll it took on him. Asked if he would have liked to take on his father's role, Kennedy says no. That chapter is closed. In the absence of any old-style family elder, the Kennedy most talked about is RFK Jr., who has attracted a larger following than most independent candidates, historian Julian E. Zellizer, author of numerous works of contemporary politics, sees JFK and his brother Robert as unifying figures, while finding Robert Jr. a symbol of division, distrust, and a kind of skepticism about the public culture. Patrick Kennedy, who otherwise declined to discuss his cousin at length, called Zellizer's comments a pretty fair statement. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did not immediately respond to requests for comment, but issued a statement on the anniversary and on his uncle's legacy. Quote, during his term in office, he upheld a vision of America as a nation of peace, a vision that was abandoned after his death, said Kennedy, who promised to put us back on the road to peace. Besides Caroline, several Kennedys hold positions in the Biden administration, including Joseph Kennedy III, grandson of Robert Kennedy, who is a special envoy to Northern Ireland, and Victoria Reggie Kennedy, Ted Kennedy's widow, and now ambassador to Austria. Patrick Kennedy is founder of the mental health advocacy group Alignment for Progress, and notes that the last bill signed into law by JFK, the Community Mental Health Act, is the foundation of a modern-day movement to restore a community-based approach to our mental health and addiction crisis. Timothy Shriver chairs the board of the Special Olympics, which his mother and President Kennedy's sister, Eunice Shriver, helped establish in the 1960s. Carrie Kennedy, Robert's daughter, is a human rights lawyer who heads the nonprofit RFK Human Rights. Carrie's sister, Rory Kennedy, is a prize-winning documentary maker whose subjects have ranged from rural Mississippi and the Iraq War to a film about her mother, Ethel.
News from Davenport, new alderman seated. Misho Lynch attended her first council meeting as an alderwoman Tuesday night. Mayor Mike Mattson administered the oath of office, and Lynch took her spot on the council for the Tuesday's meeting, where the council discussed rezoning a plot of land from industrial to multifamily and decided to delay a vote on a request to waive sidewalk installation near a daycare. "I'm excited to get started," Lynch said following the meeting. "I'm excited that I get to have a voice and ask questions." Lynch hugged her 19-year-old daughter, who had watched the meeting from the audience. Lynch said she's been doing a lot of research and reading of past agendas to prepare. She's looking forward to challenging people to think outside the box, find other ways, and compromise. "Well, where there's a will, there's a way, and if you get enough people together that want to find a solution, then you can find a solution," Lynch said, adding that she felt empathy would be important as a council member. Voters elected Lynch in November to represent the 7th Ward. Her predecessor, Derek Cornett, was removed from the council in a 7-3 vote over allegations of sexual harassment of staff and intoxication during meetings. Cornett is currently suing the city over the decision, with his attorney arguing that Cornett's due process rights were violated. Mattson had previously said he planned to swear in whoever won election to the 7th Ward seat in November rather than waiting until January. Mark?
Cruise passengers' rights. If you think air travelers get the short end of the stick, consider the poor cruise passenger who hardly gets any stick at all. In all of travel, you won't find another purchase in which you have less recourse if something goes wrong. Yes, air travelers need more protection, and we consumer advocates are working with the Department of Transportation to enact needed new rules, but cruise passengers, along with hotel guests and folks who rent cars, have no government agency that's even supposed to look after their interest or protect them from abuses. And recent events highlight the abuses cruise passengers face. When you cruise, you pay the entire cruise price in advance, maybe months in advance, and a lot can happen between when you buy and when you sail. The only rights, in quotes, you have are those specified in the contract you sign, but probably don't even bother to read carefully, I believe it's supposed to be, when you pay. And that contract is about a one-sided as any you'll ever see. The typical cruise contract allows the cruise line to make drastic changes without your right to refund or price adjustment. Cancel any cruise, change sailing date, change or omit any scheduled port visit. Typically, you can get a full refund, less some handling charges, if you cancel a long time in advance. Maybe 6 months, but if you cancel within less than a month or two, you get nothing back. The recent violence in Israel graphically illustrates the problem. Clearly, with rockets flying around, you probably don't want to visit Israel, and no cruise line wants to put its ships, crews, or passengers at risk. Nobody would argue that a cruise line should have to fulfill a cruise promise to call at Haifa in that environment. But few would argue that a person who bought a cruise promising stops to get a full refund if the cruise can't stop in the Holy Land. Sadly, that's not the case. Cruise lines are dropping ports in the region, and most are stonewalling consumers who paid for those stops. When they make major itinerary changes, some cruise lines offer a credit toward a future cruise, but I haven't heard of any of that are offering cash refunds. Recognizing the worries customers can face, the big cruise lines developed a passenger bill of rights published through the Cruise Lines International Association, known as CLIA, and most cruise lines have incorporated its provisions as part of the contract. But the rights you get are mostly puffery for one basic reason. Although the bill makes a bunch of promises, there is absolutely no, quote, what do you get when we miss provision if a cruise line fails to meet its promises? Moreover, the only specified refund promises are limited to changes due to mechanical failure of the ship. Otherwise, nothing. Cruise passenger rights is something of a stepchild in the consumer advocacy world. Most of us are focused on an airline issue and, to a lesser extent, hotel problems. But cruise passengers need some basic rights too, and the advocacy community should get on this problem. Meanwhile, what can you do to avoid having your full payment confiscated if you don't want to accept a change? Certainly, hoping for some future government protection isn't going to do you much good. Instead, travel insurance can help, although a few standard cruise policies may cover some aspects of itinerary changes. Your most comprehensive defense is a, quote, cancel for any reason policy. Those usually cost more than the conventional policies and cover only a portion, maybe 75% of your risk, but at least you retain the right to cancel if you don't like the changes. Excuse me. Most cruises proceed without major changes, but events that require changes in cruise itineraries can sometimes arise without warning. You can't predict or foresee events such as war in Israel, fire in Maui, low water stretches on the Danube, or floods on the Rhine, or volcanoes in Iceland, but they can derail even the best planned cruises. For now, you can either take your chances or buy extra cost insurance and hope for some forceful government actions at some time.
States strive to make parks, trails more accessible. This is written by Tom Peterson for Stateline.org. Dateline Two Harbors, Minnesota. Perched high on rugged cliffs overlooking Lake Superior, Split Rock Lighthouse dominates the shoreline. Visitors from across the country make the 113-year-old beacon one of the most photographed lighthouses in the country. The most spectacular view, many say, is from Pebble Beach, reachable only by a steep, winding forest trail that snakes its way to the rocky shore. The view is the reward for the effort it takes to reach the beach, but for visitors with mobility challenges, it would be inaccessible. I've lived here for 43 of my years, and I did not know where all these photographers were getting those things, said Jenna Undenberg, a disability advocate and accessibility educator who lives in Two Harbors. No longer. Since August, the park has provided an all-terrain chair with tank-like treads to people with disabilities, opening this vista to everyone as part of a multifaceted statewide push to expand access to the outdoors. Minnesota is not alone. In recent years, there has been a growing awareness of the need to make outdoor recreation more accessible, said Mike Passo, executive director of American Trails, which supports the development of trails and greenways. Passo said other states, including California, Michigan, Vermont, and Wisconsin, also have made significant strides. In Minnesota, such efforts got a significant boost earlier this year when legislators funded the Department of Natural Resources $149.9 million Get Out More, Modernize Outdoor Recreation Experiences initiative. Major pieces include $34.5 million for more accessible recreational equipment and revitalized trails and parks and on public lands, and $9.5 million to modernize facilities such as campgrounds and lodges, many of which date to the Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps and Works Progress Administration. Udenberg was diagnosed with juvenile arthritis at age 7 and began using a wheelchair at 8. Her access to the best beaches vanished. Although she supplemented her manual chair with a power unit, trails like those at Split Rock Lighthouse State Park were too steep. her power chair would get down, but there'd be no way of getting back, she said. Minnesota, which has the nation's second oldest state park system, purchased track chairs for 5 state parks in 2022 and expanded the program to 13 parks, including Split Rock, this year. They span from the rugged northeastern shoreline, home to moose and wolves, to Blue Mounds on the state's southwestern prairie, where the trails offer the chance to spot grazing bison. At Split Rock, which attracts more than 500,000 visitors annually, officials tested the chair on the park's terrain, documenting routes that would fit the chair's range. Steep climbs drain the battery more than flat terrain, so park employees mapped out suggested routes to tackle in the 2,200-acre park. There is no charge to use the chair. In the first 35 days of the program, the chair was reserved 22 days, said Ward Wallen, park supervisor at Split Rock. People are using it. They're posting on Facebook and other social media outlets, and I think pretty soon it's going to be really, really packed, said Wallen, who added that park officials plan to test the chair for winter use. The chairs range in cost from $14,000 to about $20,000, according to Adam Henning, marketing and manager at Action Manufacturing, which manufactures the chairs used in the Minnesota parks. Michigan has 13 locations and Georgia has 10 locations. They are also early adopters and have chairs in multiple locations, he said. A lot of state parks have taken notice. Michigan has taken a different approach, primarily relying on private money to pay for track chairs in its state parks. The Department of Natural Resources website lists more than a dozen parks and recreation areas with a total of 18 chairs in place or coming soon. It also included something the Minnesota site does not have, a donation button. Wisconsin's Open the Outdoors program offers wide-ranging opportunities from beach-capable chairs to cross-country sit skis, but the state is taking a measured approach to track chairs. User needs vary, said Nick Zhuski, as accessibility coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and a chair designed for an urban park might not work for a hunting area. Also, money is limited. Iowa also has budget concerns and is exploring outside funding options for chairs, according to Sherry Arntzen, Bureau Chief for Parks, Forests, and Preserves with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. In the meantime, the agency has made gains in providing modified kayak launching areas. A current priority is auditing and updating facilities, including historic structures that are nearly 100 years old, to improve their accessibility. If there's things that we're not providing that we should be, we're identifying now so that we can put that plan together to make those additional modifications as needed. Because just like other park systems, you've got a gamut on the age of some of your infrastructure, Arntzen said. Some state parks also offer chairs that bring visitors onto beaches or even into the water. In several Massachusetts state parks, for example, visitors can use 4-wheeled sunbathing chairs on the beach or 3-wheeled floating chairs in the ocean. Mark?
Super pigs from Canada threaten to invade northern U.S. This is out of Minneapolis. An exploding population of hard-to-eradicate super pigs, in quotes, in Canada is threatening to spill south of the border, and northern states like Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana are taking steps to stop the invasion. In Canada, the wild pigs roaming Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba pose a new threat. They are often crossbreeds that combine the survival skills of wild Eurasian boar with the size and high fertility of domestic swine to create a super pig, in quotes, that's spreading out of control. Brian Brook, a professor at the University of Saskatchewan and one of the Canada's leading authorities on the problem, calls feral swine the most invasive animal on the planet and an ecological train wreck. Pigs are not native to north of the continent for centuries. Canada's problem dates back only to the 1980s when it encouraged farmers to raise wild boar, Brooks said. The market collapsed after peaking in 2001, and some frustrated farmers simply cut their fences, setting the animals free. It turned out that the pigs were very good at surviving Canadian winters. Smart, adaptable, and furry, they eat anything including crops and wildlife. They tear up land when they root for bugs and crops. They can spread devastating diseases to hog farms like African swine fever. And they reproduce quickly. A sow can have 6 piglets in a litter and raise 2 litters a year. That means 65% or more of a wild pig population could be killed every year, and it will still increase, Brooks said. Hunting just makes the problem worse, he said. The success rate for hunters is only about 2% to 3%, and several states banned hunting because it makes the pigs more wary and nocturnal, tougher to track down and eradicate. Wild pigs cause about $2.5 billion in damage to U.S. crops every year, mostly in southern states like Texas. They also can be aggressive toward humans. A woman in Texas was killed by wild pigs in 2019. Eradication of wild pigs is no longer possible in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, Brooks said. But the situation isn't hopeless everywhere, and a few U.S. states have eliminated them. The key, he said, is having a detection system that finds them early and fast, then responding quickly. Brooke and his colleagues documented 62,000 wild pig sightings in Canada. Their aerial surveys have spotted them on both sides of the Canada-North Dakota border. They also recorded a sighting of Manitoba within 18 miles of Minnesota. Quote, nobody should be surprised when pigs start walking across that border if they haven't already, Book said. The question is, what will be done about it?
Vehicle crashes, blows up at Canadian crossing. Governor says incident at bridge is not thought to be an act of terrorism. Dateline Niagara Falls, New York, a car that crashed and exploded Wednesday morning on the American side of the Rainbow Bridge in Niagara Falls, killing 2 people, does not appear to be an act of terrorism, New York Governor Kathy Hochul said at a news conference. Several agencies are investigating the incident that came on the eve of Thanksgiving, one of the busiest U.S. travel days of the year. The governor said it wasn't clear if the driver, a Western New York resident, intentionally headed for the bridge across the Niagara River before the crash. Security camera video released by the U.S. government showed the car race through an intersection on a wet road, hit a median, and vault into the air in a U.S. Customs and Border Protection area near the main vehicle checkpoint. The car flew for yards, then crashed into booths out of camera's view. 2 people in the vehicle were killed and a customs officer was hurt. The 2 victims were a husband and wife, according to a person briefed on the investigation who spoke on condition of anonymity. The incident prompted the closure of 4 border crossings in the region for hours. Fewer Americans seek unemployment benefits. Labor Department report shows U.S. job market is still resilient. Dateline Washington, the number of Americans who applied for unemployment benefits fell sharply last week, a sign the U.S. job market remains resilient despite higher interest rates. The Labor Department reported Wednesday that jobless claims dropped by 24,000 to 209,000. The previous week's total, 233,000, was the highest since August. The 4-week moving average of claims, which smooths out week-to-week volatility, fell by 750 to 220,000. The applicants are viewed as a proxy for layoffs and remain very low by historic standards, signaling most Americans enjoy unusual job security. Overall, 1.84 million Americans receive unemployment benefits the week that ended November 11th, down from 22,000 from the week before. The Federal Reserve raised its benchmark interest rate 11 times since March 2022 to slow the economy and rein in inflation that hit a four-decade high last year. The job market and economic growth remain surprisingly resilient, but hiring slowed from the breakneck pace of 2021 and 2022 when the economy roared back from the COVID-19 pandemic recession. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Our next topic is supposed to be obituaries. However, the obituaries for the Quad City Times were read yesterday, so I will read a quick article about Don Walsh. Deep sea explorer Don Walsh dies. This is written for The Associated Press by Mark Tyson. Retired Navy Captain Don Walsh, an explorer who in 1960 was part of the two-man crew that made the first voyage to the deepest part of the ocean, to the snuff-colored zone, ooze, the snuff-colored ooze at the bottom of the Pacific Mariana Trench, has died. He was 92. Walsh died November 12th at his home in Myrtle Point, Oregon, his daughter Elizabeth Walsh said Monday. In January of 1960, Walsh, then a U.S. Navy lieutenant, and Swiss engineer Jacques Picard were sealed inside a 100-ton named the Trieste to attempt to dive nearly 7 miles below the surface. The Bathyscape is a self-propelled submersible used in deep-sea dives. The two men descended to 35,800 feet, that's 11,000 meters. Trench, about 200 miles off Guam in the Pacific. After a descent of about 5 hours, the steel-hulled submersible touched down on what the log described as the ooze, snuff-colored ooze of silt stewed up by the ship reaching the bottom. When they reached the seafloor, the two men shook hands. "I knew we were making history," Walsh told the World newspaper of Coos Bay, Oregon, in 2010. "It was a special day. After spending 20 minutes on the floor and confirming there was life there when a fish swam by, they began their 3.5-hour ascent. We were astounded to find higher marine life forms down there at all," Picard said before his death in 2008. Picard designed the ship with his father, and they sold it to the U.S. Navy in 1958. Walsh was temporarily serving in San Diego when Picard requested volunteers to operate the vehicle. Walsh stepped forward. "There was an opportunity to pioneer," Walsh told the World. "I wasn't sure what I was going to be doing, but I knew I'd be at sea. And it wasn't until later that they told us what they had in store." Walsh was born November 2, 1931, in Berkeley, California. He joined the Navy at age 17 and graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. He earned a master's degree and a doctorate in oceanography from Texas A&M. He served in the Navy for 24 years, retiring with the rank of captain and serving on various submarines. He then became a professor at the University of Southern California before opening his own marine consulting business in 1976. In 2010, he received the Navy Distinguished Public Service Award and served on many boards, including as a policy advisor to the U.S. State Department. Walsh was a Navy officer, a submariner, an adventurer, and an oceanographer. To his family, we extend our deepest condolences and gratitude for allowing him to explore and share his extraordinary experiences and knowledge with us, Chief of Naval Research Rear Admiral Kurt Rosenhaus said in a Navy press release. Walsh traveled the world, including many trips to Antarctica, where the Walsh Spur Pointed Rock is named in his honor. His daughter said one of the earliest lessons she and her brother Kelly learned from their parents is that the world is not a scary place, a lesson that was reinforced because their parents always came home after their various travels. He encouraged them to venture out as well. "Don't be scared of it. Go have adventures, learn things, meet people," she recalled him teaching. He certainly instilled an enthusiastic curiosity about the world in Kelly and I, and that's a tremendous gift. In 2020, Kelly Walsh made his own journey to the bottom of the Challenger Deep in a vessel owned and piloted by Dallas explorer Victor Vesco. "An extraordinary explorer, oceanographer, human being. I'm so honored that I could call him my friend," Vesco Covo posted on X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, the day after Don Walsh's death. In addition to his children, he is also survived by his wife of 61 years, Joan.
Record crowds expected to travel. Despite inflation and memories of past holiday travel meltdowns, millions of people are expected to hit airports and highways in record numbers over the Thanksgiving break. The Transportation Security Administration expected to screen 2.6 million passengers on Tuesday and 2.7 million passengers on Wednesday. Sunday will draw the largest crowds with estimated 2.9 million passengers. Sunday will draw the largest crowds, which would narrowly eclipse a record set on June 30th. Meanwhile, AAA forecasts that 55.4 million Americans will travel at least 50 miles a day in the Sunday after Thanksgiving, with roads likely to be the most clogged on Wednesday. The weather could snarl air and road traffic. A storm system was expected to move from the southern plains to the northeast on Tuesday and Wednesday, bringing possible thunderstorms, sleet, and snow. Parts of Maine, Vermont, northern New Hampshire were expected to get 3 to 7 inches of snow between Tuesday night and Wednesday. The U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said during a Monday news conference that the government tried to better prepare for holiday travel over the last year by hiring more air traffic controllers, opening new air routes along the East Coast, and providing grants to airports for snow plows and de-icing equipment. But he warned travelers to check road conditions and flight times before leaving home. Mother Nature, of course, is the X factor in all of this, he said. The good news for travelers by plane and car alike, prices are coming down. Airfares average $268 per ticket, down 14% from a year ago, according to travel site Hopper. Gas prices are down about 45 cents a gallon from this time last year. The national average was $3.30 per gallon Monday, according to AAA, down from $3.67 a year ago. Thanksgiving marks the start of the holiday travel season, and many still haven't shaken last December's nightmares before Christmas, when severe winter storms knocked out thousands of flights and left millions of passengers stranded. Scott Keyes, founder of the travel site Going, is cautiously optimistic that holiday air travel won't be the same mess. So far this year, he said, airlines have avoided massive disruptions. Quote, everyone understands that airlines can't control Mother Nature, and it's unsafe to take off or land in the middle of a thunderstorm or snowstorm, Keyes said. What really irks people are the controllable cancellations, whose widespread disruptions because the airline couldn't get their act together because their system melted down the way Southwest did over Christmas. Indeed, Southwest didn't recover as quickly as other carriers from last year's storm, when its planes, pilots, and flight attendants were trapped out of position and its crew rescheduling system got bogged down. The airline canceled almost 17,000 flights before fixing the operation. Federal regulators told Southwest recently that it could be fined for failing to help stranded travelers. U.S. Airlines, as a whole, has been better about stranding passengers. Through October, they canceled 38% fewer flights than during the same period in 2022. From June through August, the rate of cancellations fell 18% compared to 2022. Even still, consumer complaints about airline service have soared, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. There have been so many complaints, the agency says, that it has only compiled figures through May. The airlines heap blame on the Federal Aviation Administration, which they say can't keep up with the growing air traffic. In fact, the Transportation Department's Inspector General reported this summer that the FAA made only limited efforts, in quotes, to fix the shortage of air traffic controllers, especially at key facilities in New York, Miami, and Jacksonville, Florida. Meanwhile, staffing levels in other parts of the airline industry largely recovered since the pandemic. After shedding tens of thousands of workers early on, airlines have been on a hiring spree since late 2020. Passenger airlines added more than 140,000 workers, an increase of almost 40% according to government figures updated last week. Airlines are using their expanded workforces to operate more flights. Southwest is the most aggressive among the big carriers, planning to offer 13% more seats over Thanksgiving than it did during the comparable 5-day stretch last year, according to travel data provider Cirium. United and Delta are growing 8% each. American will grow a more modest 5%, but still have the largest number of seats.
We do have time for one opinion. The letters to the editor for the Quad City Times were read yesterday, but we have one opinion that has not been read yet, so I will read that at this time. It's called "Abortion Will Sink a No-Labels Presidential Bid." This is written by Mark Tyson, who is a political columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. In announcing last week that he will not seek re-election to the Senate and hinting at a third-party presidential bid, Senator Joe Manchin III, Democrat from West Virginia, wrote an op-ed in which he decried the lack of bipartisanship in Washington. His first example, the Senate's failure to pass his legislation to reverse Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization and codify Roe v. Wade. Big mistake. Abortion is the third rail that will kill a no-labels presidential bid, and the Dobbs decision is what makes a no-labels bid viable. The rap against no-labels is that a 2024 ticket will help elect Donald Trump by siphoning votes from President Joe Biden without drawing significant Republican support away from Trump. Well, if Manchin runs next year on a promise to reverse Dobbs, that will definitely be the case. The GOP is a pro-life party. According to Gallup, more than three-quarters of Republicans call themselves pro-life, the most in nearly 30 years of Gallup polling. And 93% support restrictions on abortions that were not permissible under Roe. This means that if No Labels wants Republican voters, it will have to win over pro-life Republicans. Many of the Trump skeptical Republicans it hopes to attract held their noses and voted for Trump in 2016 precisely because the Supreme Court was on the ballot. After the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, the court's conservative majority was in peril, and Trump promised to nominate conservative justices. He kept that promise, putting three outstanding and young conservatives onto the high court who delivered the votes for historic Dobbs decision. Does Manchin think these Republican voters are now going to turn around and opt for a third-party ticket that promises to overturn the decision that was the very reason they grudgingly supported Trump in the first place? Ironically, that decision is what has freed pro-life Republicans to consider voting for No Labels. Dobbs took the abortion issue out of federal hands and sent it to the states. That means No Labels can be neutral on abortion, promising to let states sort it out, which would allow it to appeal to both abortion opponents and supporters. No Labels should take a position similar to that of former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who has currently pointed out that there are not enough votes in the Senate for federal abortion legislation anyway. Manchin opposes getting rid of the filibuster, which means 60 votes would be needed to pass a law either restricting or loosening abortion access. Why would No Labels take a divisive stand, one it cannot deliver on, that would only alienate the very voters it needs to win? No third party has ever come close to winning the presidency, but there are reasons next year's election might be a moment that defies this history. First, the level of dissatisfaction with both parties' leading candidates is unprecedented. Large majorities of Americans say they do not want a Trump-Biden rematch, but few Republicans who don't want Trump will vote for Biden, and most Democrats who don't want Biden as their nominee certainly won't vote for Trump. They have no safe harbor. A bipartisan unity ticket could give them a palatable alternative that they're longing for. Conservative voters, who would normally never even think of supporting a third-party nominee, might be willing to consider doing so this time around, given they just secured a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. Many pro-life Republicans might feel free to take a risk, but not for a ticket that promises to reverse the gains that they've made in the Supreme Court. No labels should appeal to them by focusing on forging bipartisan consensus on other pressing issues such as inflation, jobs, border security, and crime, not on divisive topics such as abortion. The only way no label stands a chance of being more than a spoiler if it appeals and wins a substantial share of the Republican vote. And the only way it can do that is by remaining neutral on abortion. It's not clear whether no labels will win a ticket or whether Manchin would lead it, but this much is certain. Without the votes of pro-life Republicans, no labels has no path to victory. If no labels runs on a promise to codify Roe, it will not only lose, it will also put Donald Trump back in the Oval Office.
And there's a page that has something that's called Talking Turkey. This might put you in the mood for Thanksgiving today. 88% of Americans who say they will be eating turkey on Thanksgiving Day. 1.28 billion in the U.S. is spent on turkeys for Thanksgiving. 61.17 cents is what the average household spends on Thanksgiving dinner for the for 10 this year. $1.71 average cost per pound of a frozen turkey. And $134 million value of U.S. pumpkin products in 2022. A little history about the holiday. In the fall of 1621, the Pilgrims, early settlers of Plymouth Colony, held a three-day feast to celebrate a bountiful harvest. Many regard this event as the nation's first Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was proclaimed a national holiday by President Abraham Lincoln on October 3rd of 1863. The holiday was to be celebrated on the last Thursday of November. In 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt clarified that Thanksgiving Day should always be celebrated on the fourth, not last, Thursday of the month to encourage earlier holiday shopping. Sometimes the last Thursday of November is the fifth. Sometimes the last Thursday of November is the fifth Thursday. Boy, it could be confusing. I could see why it's hard. Shopping the day after Thanksgiving, which is called Black Friday, for some reason, is the traditional start to the holiday shopping season. Here's a look at the planned spending. 46% of Americans who say they started browsing or buying by the holidays. 196.7 million number of shoppers over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend last year. $875 is the amount on average consumer plan to spend on decorations, candy, and gift. And that's not going to be me. 2023 forecast, airports and roads may seem jam-packed this year as AAA predicts 55.4 million people will travel for Thanksgiving, up to 2.3% from 2022, and third highest since 2000. And that's all I have on little tips for Thanksgiving.
All right. We're going to sneak in one at least sports article here from the Quad City Times. This is titled Fast Break, Your Guide to the Week in College Basketball. Early tests. Coaches use Thanksgiving tournaments to grow, build. This is written by Aaron Beard for the Associated Press. Holiday hoop season has arrived. The week's AP Top 25 schedule is filled with Thanksgiving week tournaments that have long been staples of the college basketball schedule, as well as made-for-TV pairings. The headliner is a loaded field at the Maui Invitational, which began play Monday with five of the top 11 teams. There's also the battle for Atlantis in the Bahamas, as well as other events in Florida, California, Missouri, and even Mexico. They all create the potential of marquee matchups, as well as the chances for teams to sort through what they do well compared to what they need to improve, the latter of which being of particular importance in a time of rapid roster overhauls through the transfer portal. That was on the mind of North Carolina coach Hubert Davis before his 14th-ranked Tar Heels play in Atlantis, mentioning a daily message his retired Hall of Fame predecessor Roy Williams shared with the previous team. Rome wasn't built in a day, but it was worked on every day. This year's team has new parts, and every day we want to take a step forward of building that team and getting closer to that finished product, Davis said last week. That applies broadly, too. The Maui field features number one Kansas, number two Purdue, number four Marquette, number seven Tennessee, and number 11 Gonzaga. This tournament relocated to Honolulu due to wildfires that devastated its longtime home in Lahaina runs through Wednesday. The Boilermakers and Volunteers won Monday to set up a Tuesday semifinal matchup, while the Zags fell into the consolation bracket after falling to Purdue. The Jayhawks and the Golden Eagles also won Monday night and met in Tuesday's the other semifinal. Battle for Atlantis. The Tar Heels, who climbed six spots in Monday's new poll, are the highest-ranking team taking the court Wednesday for the eight-team tournament in Paradise Island, Bahamas. They'll open against Northern Iowa in the first game, with the tournament running through Friday. The field also includes number 20, Arkansas, which comes in off a home loss to UNC Greensboro that dropped the Razorback six spots Monday. Arkansas opens play there against Stanford. The field also includes Villanova, which fell out of the poll Monday, and Memphis, which was the leading vote-getter among unranked teams. The Tigers open against Michigan, and a good showing at the Atlantis Resort could propel them into next week's ratings. Third-ranked Arizona has already earned a marquee win this season at Duke. The Wildcats have another such matchup on the schedule on Thanksgiving Day against number 21, Michigan State. That game takes place in Desert Palm, California. Multiple events are taking place in Florida this week, with ranked teams including number 18 Colorado in the Sunshine Slam in Daytona Beach and number 24 Virginia in the Fort Myers Tip-Off. The ESPN Events Invitational features number 12 Texas A&M and number 19 Florida Atlantic as the headliners in Kissimmee. They could meet in the semifinals of an event that opens Thursday and runs through Sunday. There's also number 17 Alabama playing Ohio State on Friday in its Emerald Coast Classic opener in Niceville. And elsewhere, eighth-ranked Creighton faces Loyola Chicago on Wednesday to open the Hall of Fame Classic in Kansas City, Missouri. Number 13 Baylor faces Oregon State on Wednesday in the NIT season tip-off in Brooklyn, while number 3 USC meets Seton Hall on Thursday in the first-year Ratty Children's Invitational near San Diego.
Here's some early tests that coaches use Thanksgiving tournaments to build. Oh, sorry, that was already read. A shooting star from Lubbock to the big time, Aberg not easily distracted. So much feels like so long ago for Ludwig Aberg. Everything's in a long way from Lubbock, Aberg playfully replied Sunday after winning at Sea Island. The question was more about time than distance, though they apply equally. Texas Tech failed to reach match play in the NCAA championship on May 29th, and that meant the end of Aberg's brilliant college career. His consolation was being the overwhelming number one player in the PGA Tour University ranking for the first time. That came with a PGA Tour card. Everyone could see the efficient swing, the purpose of his putting stroke, and the remarkable poise. He joined John Rahm and the only back-to-back winner of the Ben Hogan Award as the nation's best college player. How that translated to the highest level of golf was still to be determined. In his pro debut, Aberg missed U.S. Open qualifying by 2 shots. That also seemed like a long time ago. In June, Aberg played with European Ryder Cup captain Luke Donald at the Rocket Mortgage Classic, leaving quite the impression by hitting every fairway and all but one green in a round by 65. In July, he tied the 4th in John Deere Classic. That the last week in August, Rory McIlroy already was dropping his name as a potential Ryder Cup rookie. "We know he's going to be on the Ryder Cup for the next 15 years," McIlroy said. "Would you rather give him a chance in Rome or throw him into the fire at Bethage?" Aberg tried for the 4th in the Czech Masters that week. He won in Switzerland the first weekend in September. Donald picked him for Europe's team, and no one was surprised, only amazed that Aberg would be the first to play in a Ryder Cup without ever having played in a major. "It's clear that I have never seen the sums of money that these people are getting before, so it's so obvious that you raise some eyebrows a little. It is life-changing money, but I still want to believe that a good player can still get by. You come out on the PGA Tour and compete. That's exactly what he has done in such a short time that he objects in his rearview mirror. Like Lubbock, seems a lot farther away than they really are."
And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Thursday, November 23rd, 2023. I'm Lisa Horsch, and my partner at the microphone has been Mark Morrison. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.